Good evening. My name's Tim Besley. I'm the director of the Suntory Toyota International Centres for Economics and Related Disciplines at the LSE, which along with the Economics Department is sponsoring this evening's lecture. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Mervyn King back to the LSE to give his lecture on 10 years of the inflation target. Mervyn is without question one of the leading economists of his generation. He's distinguished himself in both academic and public life. He was educated at Cambridge and Harvard. He then taught at Cambridge for a number of years, moving from there to Birmingham and finally to a chair at LSE, which he held between 1984 and 1995. While he was at the school, he played a key role in Stickard, and he left his mark in founding the Financial Markets Group, which continues to thrive today at the LSE. As an academic, Mervyn did most of the fundamental work on corporate taxation, which still forms the backbone of our understanding in this area. He won many academic honours. He's a fellow of the British Academy and of the Econometric Society. He's also a foreign honorary member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Since leaving LSE, Mervyn has become a major contributor to British public life. He served successively as chief economist and deputy governor of the Bank of England, the position which he now holds. He was a founder member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, where his voice is well known to be an influential one. As many of you will also know, he presents the Bank of England's quarterly inflation report, a key barometer for those who are, for those interest rate pundits out there. He contributes to public life in many other ways, not least as a member of the Advisory Council of the London Symphony Orchestra. Mervyn, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here, and we look forward to your reflections on the inflation target 10 years on. Thank you for coming.
Tim, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, 10 years ago, in this very room, Robin Lee Pemberton, then Governor, now Lord Kingsdown, delivered the first LSE Bank of England lecture. It was entitled The Case for Price Stability. In the 25 years prior to that lecture, prices had risen by over 750%, more than over the previous 250 years. So the audience on that evening in November 1992 had grown up in a world in which rising prices appeared inevitable. They were the inflation generation. To them, price stability seemed remote. Inflation was simply taken for granted. But that lecture coincided with the introduction of a new monetary framework, the inflation target. And since then, price stability has become a reality. Over the past decade, inflation has averaged 2.5%, and has been no lower than 1.5% and no higher than 3.3%. Alan Greenspan defined price stability as when expected changes in the average price level are small enough and gradual enough that they do not materially enter business and household decisions. Inflation is no longer a material concern to families and businesses in this country. Alan Blinder, who was Alan Greenspan's deputy at the Federal Reserve, put it even more clearly. Price stability, he said, was when ordinary people stopped talking and worrying about inflation. And so successful has been the pursuit of low inflation that some commentators have talked about the death of inflation and others about the prospect of deflation. Tonight I want to re-examine the case for price stability and ask the following questions. Did the benefits of low inflation promised 10 years ago materialize? Is the case for price stability the same as in 1992? What does price stability mean in practice? And what are the challenges for monetary policy over the next decade? Although inflation targeting in this country is now 10 years old, the most significant institutional changes occurred 5 years ago. Decisions on interest rates were taken out of the political arena in May 1997 and delegated to the new Monetary Policy Committee. Exactly 200 years to the very month since the famous Gilray cartoon, shown in your handout, introduced the name the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street. It's too soon to compare the 9-member Monetary Policy Committee with the Council of Nine that ruled Siena during the 14th century. And exactly 660 years before the Chancellor created the MPC, the Council of Nine commissioned Lorenzetti to paint marvelous frescoes in the Palazzo Pubblico in Siena, showing the virtues of good government and the vices of bad government. There are few more convincing representations of the case for stability than these frescoes. Since the MPC has not, at least yet, discovered a modern Lorenzetti, I shall present the case for price stability in a more orthodox, if less compelling, visual form. See chart one. This is primitive art rather than the Renaissance. Chart one in the handout shows consumer price inflation in this country over the past 50 years. The decade of inflation targeting stands out as a period of low and stable inflation. Table one shows that not only has inflation been lower since inflation targeting was introduced, but also that it has been more stable than for decades. Now, this fall in inflation has led to sharp reductions in nominal interest rates at both short and long horizons, as shown in Table 2. The difference between yields on conventional and index-linked government securities measure what I will call the total inflation premium, the sum of expected inflation and the inflation risk premium. And in Chart 2, you can see that the total inflation premium fell significantly on the announcement of Bank of England independence and the creation of the MPC in May 1997. So price stability appears to have led to a more stable macroeconomic environment, with fewer surprises to inflation and less inflation uncertainty. Did this produce greater stability of the real economy? Well, Table 3 shows that since 1992, output has grown at a little above its 40-year average and has been much more stable than before. The standard deviation of quarterly growth rates was less than half that in earlier decades. Can these gains in terms of greater stability be attributed to a more stable monetary regime? After all, a skeptic might argue that the causation runs from a more stable economic environment to lower inflation. But some of those alternative explanations, such as the rise in the share of services in total output and better inventory management, are part of longer-term trends and do not fit well with the observation that volatility has fallen sharply over the past decade. And shocks to the UK from the world economy and from the sterling real exchange rate have been as large, if not larger, over the past 5 years as in earlier periods. What is the mechanism by which monetary policy contributes to a more stable economy? I would argue that monetary policy now is more systematic and predictable than before. Put simply, monetary policy is not adding to the volatility of the economy in a way that it did in earlier decades. Let me turn to the question of what have we learnt about the case for price stability over the past 10 years. The costs of departing from price stability, either inflation or deflation, depend upon whether that is expected or comes as a surprise. And I shall focus tonight on three main costs of unanticipated inflation. You can read all about anticipated inflation in the full text of the lecture on the Bank of England website. The first cost I want to examine is distortions to production and investment resulting from mistakes in distinguishing between relative and absolute price changes. The crucial link between price stability and production and investment is that high inflation is associated with more volatile and uncertain inflation. We saw earlier that as inflation has fallen in Britain, so too has its variability. The same link can be seen in cross-section data. Chart 4 shows the relationship between average inflation and its variability for a sample of 144 countries. And in all cases, it's clear that inflation uncertainty increases with the average inflation rate. But does this link between inflation and its volatility mean that higher inflation results in greater variability of relative prices? Chart 5 provides the answer for the UK. This was constructed using monthly data on 80 subcomponents of the Retail Prices Index. And the chart shows the relationship between the standard deviation of those prices and the relative prices and the inflation rate. At low inflation rates, say up to about 4% a year, it seems that variability in relative prices does not move inflation systematically in one direction or another. Increases in house prices move the inflation rate up, and falls in oil prices move inflation down. But it's at higher rates of inflation or deflation that the deviation of inflation from zero seems to be positively correlated with the variability of relative prices. So outside a range close to price stability, the higher the inflation rate, the greater is the variability of relative prices. So inflation makes it more difficult for firms and households to work out whether the prices of the products they buy and sell have changed relative to other goods, or whether there has simply been a change in the overall price level. Such confusion can lead firms, at least temporarily, to produce the wrong level of output. And if many of firms make these mistakes at the same time, then the result is an unnecessary fluctuation in aggregate output. But perhaps more interesting is the effect of uncertainty about prices on the level of investment. Many investments are specific to a particular model or product, and so they become sunk costs. For such irreversible investments, it may pay to wait before investing, since time will resolve some of the uncertainty. A Premiership football team may decide to postpone the construction of a new stadium until their survival in the league is assured. Or a car manufacturer may postpone a decision about opening a new plant to see if a rise in demand is temporary and appears likely to last. In the language of finance, there is an option value to waiting when there is uncertainty about the returns on an uncertain and irreversible investment. So a project must offer a rate of return sufficient not only to cover the cost of financing the project, but also the option value to waiting. That may explain why surveys of firms show that their hurdle rates of return are often well in excess of the cost of either equity or debt finance. And if uncertainty about inflation creates an option value to waiting, then it will reduce investment. The uncertainty could stem from a difficulty in disentangling relative from absolute prices. And there is growing empirical evidence that inflation is a key explanatory variable for cross-country differences in investment. The second cost of unanticipated inflation I want to examine is redistribution of wealth between debtors and creditors. Unexpected changes in the price level, the standard of value used to define contracts, produce arbitrary redistributions of wealth. As Lenin remarked, the best way to destroy capitalism is to debauch the currency. It is arguable as to whether inflation or deflation produces the greater economic damage. In Europe in the 1920s, hyperinflation undermined economic and social arrangements, as it has done more recently in Latin America. But deflation has proved just as unpopular as inflation. In 274 AD, the Roman Emperor Aurelian try to restore the integrity of the coinage, which had been adulterated by workmen in the mint. Aurelian exchanged good money for bad and ordered the destruction of accounts drawn up in the devalued currency. In the long run, the operation restored the value of money. But in the short run, it caused hardship. In his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbon observed that a temporary grievance of such a nature can scarcely excite and support a serious civil war. Unfortunately, taking a different and more Keynesian view, that in the long run we are all dead, the population at the time rose in insurrection. Many of them found that they were dead in the short run too, with 7,000 soldiers and countless civilians perishing during the suppression of the uprising. Now, wealth redistributions arising from unanticipated deflation can lower aggregate demand. Why? Since it is difficult either to borrow or insure against uncertain future employment and earnings opportunities, current assets act as a buffer stock to make it possible to smooth consumption in the face of shocks to future prospects. When net worth is small, it is risky to run down the buffer stock even further, and so the marginal propensity to spend out of wealth is much higher for households with low wealth, low net worth, than for families whose assets comfortably exceed their liabilities. If significant numbers of debtors have little net worth, recent first-time house buyers with high debt-to-value ratios are a prime example, then an unanticipated deflation could cause a sharp fall in aggregate consumption spending. Such effects can be amplified if spending, consumption, or investment depends on the value of the assets that are used as collateral for loans. A fall in prices can produce a vicious circle in which the initial fall in demand lowers asset prices, reducing the value of collateral, which in turn leads borrowers to repay debt, exacerbating the original decline in aggregate demand. This debt deflation was first formulated clearly by Irving Fisher in the 1930s and has recently been revived in a more sophisticated form by Nobu Kiyotaki and John Moore here at the LSE. The experience of Japan may add to our knowledge in this area, although, as you can see from chart 6, despite a stagnant economy over the past decade, deflation of consumer prices has not been especially large. I turn now to the third of the costs of unanticipated inflation, aversion to long-term contracts with a change in the inflation regime. The move from a regime of high inflation to one of low inflation can have consequences which again I think are best illustrated by the housing market. A credible move to inflation targeting can bring down inflation expectations relatively quickly. Chart 7 shows that inflation expectations, as measured by surveys, fell steadily following the introduction of inflation targeting and are now anchored on the 2.5% target. But a move to low inflation has other consequences that are less easily understood. Price stability means lower nominal interest rates, and so lower mortgage payments. But the lower mortgage payment largely reflects a rise in the effective duration of the loan, because inflation no longer erodes the real value of the debt as quickly as before. In a low inflation world, nominal incomes rise more slowly than before, and the real burden of servicing the debt persists. It may take longer for households to work out the impact of low inflation on real interest rates than on the prices of everyday purchases. Learning takes time. One possible consequence is that households may, for a time, mistake too much of the reduction in nominal interest rates for a permanent fall in the real rate. As a result, asset prices are bid up to levels that prove unsustainable. How far this theoretical argument applies to the British housing market at present is difficult to say. But it demonstrates the risks from current house price to earnings ratios that are close to the peaks reached in the late 1980s. So there is a strong case, I think, for price stability. But what does price stability mean in practice? Recall that the definitions of price stability offered by Alan Greenspan and Alan Blinder are rather general in nature and make no reference to particular indexes of prices or precise numbers for inflation. There are good reasons for this. The prices of the goods that I buy may rise at a different rate from the goods that you buy. And the basket of goods and services that you buy today is very different from the basket that you could or would have bought 50 or 100 years ago. The official retail price index now includes computers and cable TV, but no longer bowler hats or the price of tickets to cricket matches. To illustrate the problems of measuring inflation, I shall draw largely on historic price material kindly provided by Harrods, mainly the Harrods catalogues. No records have been kept after 1970, so we have supplemented this historical data by our own researches. And I'm very grateful to the young Bank of England economist who was apprehended in the food hall, suspected of comparing prices for a competitor who was opening a store across the road. In those days, the telegraphic address of Harrods was everything London. The internet today has nothing on Harrods 100 years ago, when a telephone service, Sloan 1234, with real people answering, was available to take orders right through the night, which were dispatched early the next day, with free local delivery, up to and including Windsor, and by mail elsewhere. According to the catalogues, a record player in Harrods in 1910 cost £11, approximately £625 in today's money. That would have bought you a hand-cranked machine that provided low-quality sound. Today you could buy a record player for as little as £39. How much have record players increased in price? Ignoring quality changes, the price rose by a factor of 3.5, that is 39 over 11. But ignoring the vast quality improvements would surely and obviously overstate this increase, a quality change bias. Is a record player still the relevant product, since record players today are only used by a small group of enthusiasts of now outdated vinyl records? Perhaps a DVD or MP3 player is the relevant product, but they are impossible to compare with a 1910 record player. And if we ignore the invention and marketing of new products, we introduce a new product bias into the measurement of inflation. Well, to illustrate the quality change and the new product bias, let us imagine that we go shopping in Harrods both today and in 1910. And let's suppose that we have £350 to spend, the same amount in both years. In 1910, you could have bought a vacuum cleaner, a record player, an iron, a camera, and a telephone. The vacuum cleaner would have spread as much dust as it removed. The record player would have been hand-cranked, and the iron would need to be filled with coal. The camera would have been bulky and awkward to set up, and the telephone would have been largely silent because so few people owned one. Today, you can buy a similar bundle of goods for the same total outlay, but all would be of vastly superior quality. So for durable goods, it's not clear that the cost of living has risen at all. If we buy food, however, the results are very different. Unlike appliances, many of the food items in 1910 are unchanged today. McVitie's digestive biscuits, Quaker oats, Rose's lime juice, Bourneville cocoa, Frank Cooper's Oxford marmalade, Marmite, Heinz baked beans, and Coleman's mustard are only some of the familiar items for which precise comparisons over the years are possible. In 1910, you could have fed yourself for 10p a day by eating Marmite on Hovis toast for breakfast, eggs, bacon and toast for lunch, Heinz beans on toast for dinner with a pint of milk to drink. The same menu, consisting of exactly the same brand products, will cost today £4.80. The food basket has therefore increased in price by a factor of 48. A vacuum cleaner, if you wanted one in 1910, cost £229. That is more than 6 years' worth of food based on the diet I just described. A vacuum cleaner was an item of such luxury that owners would invite their friends round to Hoover parties to show off their prized possession. Although the price of food increased in nominal terms by a factor of 48, the price of vacuum cleaners has stayed roughly the same. Today you can buy a vacuum cleaner for the price of only 47 days of food rather than 6 years. And as vacuum cleaners have become cheaper relative to food, people bought more of them. And ignoring such changes in the composition of expenditure would introduce a substitution bias, which would greatly understate the increase in the average cost of living. And of course, Harrods is not exactly the typical place to go shopping. There was not much talk in 1910 of suburban shopping centres or internet shopping. And ignoring developments in retail practice introduces an outlet bias into the measure of inflation. Quality change bias, new product bias, substitution bias, and outlet bias. These are some of the issues that show how difficult it is to measure changes in the price level over time. Precision is not to be had. Does this matter for price stability? Probably not. The Greenspan blinder definitions of price stability suggest that we know price stability when we see it, or rather, when we stop hearing about inflation. There is nothing mystical about the RPIX measure of inflation, nor the figure of 2.5%. But it is important to have a precise numerical target, which is easy to understand, in order to provide an anchor for inflation expectations and to which the MPC can be held accountable. Let me turn finally to the challenges facing monetary policy over the next decade. Although inflation targeting has delivered many of the benefits from low inflation that were promised 10 years ago, there remain real challenges for monetary policy over the next decade. Two questions have been prominent recently. First, is inflation targeting enough? Second, is deflation, not inflation, the main threat at present? Is inflation targeting enough? Do rapid increases in asset prices pose a threat to stability, even though inflation targeting has delivered steady growth with low inflation? Some commentators have suggested that monetary policy target asset prices in addition to inflation. But which asset prices? And what would that mean for interest rates? House prices have risen rapidly. That might suggest that interest rates should have been higher. Sterling has for 6 years now been around 30% higher against the euro or its predecessors than before. The trade deficit has grown and the profitability of manufacturing industry has fallen by 2/3. That might suggest that interest rates should have been lower. Equity prices rose by 120% between 1995 and 2000, before falling 40% subsequently. Presumably, that would have implied higher interest rates at first and then lower interest rates subsequently. What this means is that asset prices cannot sensibly be viewed in isolation, but only in the context of the economy as a whole. The immediate question is whether changes in asset prices have led to an imbalance within the economy that poses the risk of a large negative demand shock at some point in the future. I believe the answer is yes. But how big is that risk is extremely difficult to judge. And so the appropriate policy response is far from clear. Beneath the surface of overall stability in the UK lies a remarkable imbalance between a buoyant consumer and housing sector on the one hand and weak external demand on the other. As a summary statistic of this imbalance, Table 4 shows that in the United Kingdom, the growth of real domestic demand exceeded the growth of output by no less than 7.5% over the 5 years to 2002 Q1, more than over any five-year period in the 1980s, and more than in any other major country during the recent past. Even the optimistic Mr. McCorber would realise that this cannot continue indefinitely. How then, and over what timescale, will these imbalances unwind? Three possibilities deserve consideration. First, the rapid growth in household consumption, averaging over 4% for the last 5 years, may reflect an adjustment to higher real disposable incomes. Consumption growth would then slow naturally as spending and debt reach their new levels. The imbalance between domestic demand and output would unwind as steadily as it built up, with no reason to fear a sudden correction. But for this to occur, the source of higher disposable incomes must be permanent or at least indefinite for the time being. In part, the recent increase has resulted from the improved terms of trade, 7% up on 5 years ago, which raise real national income for any given level of output. The main threat to the persistence of that improvement is the possibility of a fall in sterling that may be a necessary part of the rebalancing of the UK economy. But so far, the path of consumer spending is not inconsistent with a benign outcome, a slow and steady unwinding of the imbalance. The second possibility, though, is that the level of debt taken out by households, the debt-to-income ratio is now at an all-time high, makes households sensitive to any adverse future shock to their employment or income prospects. In that event, the risk is of a sharper adjustment of consumption to the shock than might otherwise have occurred. Monetary policy would respond, but a large negative demand shock might result in an undershoot of the inflation target for some considerable time. The third possibility I touched on earlier. Households may adjust more quickly to the implications of a low inflation world for the prices of goods and services than for nominal interest rates or the growth of nominal incomes. A mistaken underestimate of real interest rates or an overestimate of nominal income growth may raise borrowing, spending, and asset prices temporarily. Eventually, households learn and consumption adjusts, but again, possibly sharply. The policy dilemma is that by allowing consumption and demand to grow rapidly now, there is a risk that there might be a large fall in demand later. In practice, it is difficult to know whether an imbalance does contain the seed of a future negative demand shock on a sufficiently large scale, or whether it will unwind of its own accord. The fact that growing imbalances might cause sharp deviations of inflation from target at some point in the future raises the possibility of a trade-off between deviations of inflation from target over the next year or so and deviations of inflation from target further ahead. That, I believe, is the right way to think about the challenge to monetary policy posed by asset price movements. Although there are no simple answers, I hope I have demonstrated that inflation targeting is enough, provided that one thinks carefully about the horizon over which policy can hope to affect inflation. The second challenge for monetary policy over the next decade is the possibility of deflation. That prices are now rising at the slowest rate for decades is, of course, a positive achievement. But is the real threat now deflation? It is important to recognize that falling prices of manufactured goods are not the same as general deflation. In fact, price stability, in the sense of RPIX inflation around 2.5% a year, is likely to mean that the prices of manufactured goods will, on average, not rise at all. Faster productivity growth in manufacturing than in services means that the prices of services will rise faster than those of manufactured goods. Table 4 shows the inflation rates for goods and services in the major economies. Positive rates of inflation for services, which account for around half of consumer spending, show deflation in most of the world economy is still some way off. In all countries, the gap between goods and services price inflation has widened somewhat in recent years, as increasing competition from new producers has driven down prices of tradable goods. But the striking feature of Table 4 is that the extent to which the gap has increased to no less than 5.7 percentage points in the UK, more than in the US and considerably more than elsewhere. That is the striking feature of the table. And exchange rate movements are largely responsible for these differences between countries. The extent to which services inflation has risen relative to goods inflation is another manifestation of the imbalance within the UK economy. Deflation, in the sense of a sustained fall in the aggregate price level, can be found among the G7 economies only in Japan, where the consumer price level has been falling almost continuously for 4 years and by a cumulative total of 4%. Elsewhere, deflation is remote. All of this serves to remind us that with a single instrument, monetary policy cannot ensure that inflation is at target and output on trend all of the time. To suppose otherwise is to believe in the myth of the straight line, as Nigel Lawson described it. Monetary policy can reduce, but not eliminate, fluctuations in output. Cycles in real activity sometimes reflect real behavior outside the influence of monetary policy. The framework introduced in 1997 explicitly recognizes that the MPC would not attempt to bring inflation back to the target immediately following a large shock. As a result, inflation might deviate from the 2.5% target by more than 1 percentage point, and that would require the governor to write an open letter to the Chancellor. Ed Balls explained in his Oxford lecture of last year, "Some people have assumed it, the requirement to write an open letter, exists for the Chancellor to discipline the MPC if inflation goes outside the target range. In fact, the opposite is true. In the face of a supply shock, such as a big jump in the oil price, which pushed inflation way off target, the MPC could only get inflation back to 2.5% quickly through a draconian interest rate response, at the expense of stability, growth, and jobs. Any sensible monetary policymaker would want a more measured and stability-oriented strategy to get inflation back to target. And it is the open letter system which both allows that more sensible approach to be explained by the MPC and allows the Chancellor publicly to endorse it." End of quote. And that applies not just to a supply shock, but also to a large demand shock that might follow a significant movement in asset prices. Both challenges to policy in the future have one aspect in common. They make us think carefully about the consequences of current policy for inflation well into the future. Asset prices raise the question of how far one should err on the side of caution while imbalances are building up. Deflation makes us aware of the risk that the zero lower bound on interest rates might bind in the future. They imply that while in normal circumstances, monetary policy should focus on meeting the inflation target 18 months or 2 years ahead, in practice it may be necessary to look even further ahead about the consequences of present actions. When Lord Kingsdown addressed the LSE 10 years ago, he said that departure from the exchange rate mechanism offered an opportunity to demolish the image of the United Kingdom as a second-rate, inflation-prone economy. I believe that opportunity was taken. Today, the UK has low and stable inflation, and that has not come at the expense of either output or employment. Britain has now experienced 41 successive quarters of positive economic growth, and unemployment in this country is lower than in any other G7 country. This greater stability is no accident. It is the product of a commitment to price stability, as reflected in an institutional design encompassing a clear inflation target and a transparent and accountable process for reaching decisions on interest rates embodied in the Monetary Policy Committee. At the beginning of my lecture, I referred to the frescoes of good and bad government by Lorenzetti. If today you go to the Palazzo Pubblico in Siena to see those marvellous paintings, in the Sala della Pace, which I translate as the Room of Stability, you will see the results of allowing daylight to fall on the walls where the frescoes are painted. Yes, greater transparency, more daylight, has damaged the paintings. But if you look carefully, you will see that whereas daylight has caused no harm to the paintings of good government, it has indeed damaged bad government on the opposite wall. And even today, Lorenzetti's frescoes tell us about the benefits of transparency and the importance of careful institutional design. 5 years ago, I argued in this room that the requirement on the governor to write an open letter to the Chancellor whenever inflation deviated from target by more than one percentage point would provide ample opportunity for the bank to restore the lost art of letter writing. So far, no letter has been required. But given Alan Blinder's definition of price stability, when ordinary people stop talking about inflation and converse instead about more important matters, I hope that the MPC will be more successful in restoring the equally lost art of good conversation. In that way, the inflation generation will give way to a new generation, a new generation able to devote its energies to the wider economic and social policies from which our attention has so often been diverted in the past by the need to control inflation. The lesson of the past 10 years is that it is stability, price stability, and the broader economic stability which it generates that is the platform for the deeper satisfaction portrayed so well in Lorenzetti's fresco.
Mervyn, thank you very much. Mervyn has indicated he's willing to take a few questions. May I ask anyone who asks a question to be very brief so that the maximum number of people have an opportunity. So I see one already down here. There'll be a microphone there.
Can you hear me? Yes. You've referred to low inflation and stability. Do you think that the recent large increases in house prices will damage that stability, in that either prices have to drop very sharply or incomes have to rise very fast to compensate? And if you do think that's the case, is there an argument for a higher rate of interest or a higher deposit basis for house prices to preserve that stability?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen to house prices. And I don't think any person who's honest ever knows what is going to happen to an asset price. What I tried to talk about in the lecture were the risks implied for the outlook for house prices. and I tried to describe three ways in which the current position of households and the housing market might unwind. One was relatively benign, two were less benign. But I think it's extremely difficult to know in advance what the magnitude of those risks are. In the inflation report which the bank published last week, the Monetary Policy Committee said that its central view was that the rate of house price inflation, the rate at which house prices are increasing, would fall fairly steadily over the next 2 years to a level at which house prices were broadly stable. That's the central view. But there are risks on either side of that. And I think no one can actually know. What the role of the MPC is to look carefully at the data as they evolve each month to see which of the explanations as to how the imbalances might unwind seem to be fitting the facts. And I think that's part of the task of the MPC. Look at the facts month by month and then judge.
Can I just follow up on the asset price issue? There have been two recent papers, one by your present colleague Christopher Allsop and one by Charles Goodhart at his Wincott lecture, where they were both, I think, uneasy about the sort of attitude to asset price situation, which is basically to say, well, we take it into account insofar as it affects our inflation forecast. And I think the worry was the threat of systemic problems in the financial system. Now, one of the things that's being put forward is this sort of one instrument situation with interest rates being geared to inflation targets. And the argument that's being put forward is that if you've got problems in the housing market and in the equity market, there may very well be other instruments which might be appropriate for those situations, which would possibly let the MPC off the hook in terms of interest rate changes. I mean, Paul Krugman's been talking about this in the States in the context of margin requirements possibly being another weapon in the arsenal. Now, isn't there a danger if we just continue with the present situation where we have the MPC deciding on interest rates and that being the extent of monetary policy instruments, that sooner or later we do have a more serious conflict, a dilemma situation? And wouldn't it be a good idea to actually think about alternative instruments? There was an article in the FT on Friday, actually, by John Calverley of American Express, which was talking about an asset valuation committee being set up as well as the MPC to deal with sort of warnings to the public at large about asset price bubbles. Wouldn't you feel it would be easier for the MPC if there was some other instrument that could be used?
Well, let me say first that the Monetary Policy Committee is not trying to be let off the hook. We've been given a very clear responsibility and it's our task to carry that out. In some ways it might appear to be attractive to find other instruments, but I don't think this is actually, the more you look at it, the more difficult that seems. The Monetary Policy Committee is the only committee I have ever been on which seemed to me an effective instrument of anything in terms of a committee. So the idea that an asset price committee is going to sit there and ruminate on whether asset prices are too high or low doesn't seem to me likely to be terribly helpful. I mean, more seriously, there are, of course, discussions of what other instruments might there be. Credit controls are one that's been discussed. But they are simply impossible to apply when you have a competitive and liberalized financial system, and in particular when you do not have foreign exchange controls. I suppose we could try to go back to the days of foreign exchange controls, but that would impose a massive inefficiency on the way the UK economy operated, and I see no reason to do that. No other country does, and no other country has found a different instrument. You mentioned margin requirements. I think it's worth pointing out that they were really discussed in the context of the great crash of the 1920s and the consequences in the early 30s. At the time of the great crash in the United States, over 10% of the value of stocks was accounted for by margin borrowing from the brokers who had carried out the transaction. Now the figure is, in the US, much less than that, about 1% or so. And the problem is that people can borrow from many other sources. We don't have official margin requirements in the UK on retail investors. There seems no need to do so. Households have many ways of borrowing. They don't choose to borrow through their brokers. So there's no easy way in which to impose such requirements. The best way to control the total scale of borrowing is by changing the level of interest rates. We have seen in Britain, with mortgage equity withdrawal, that loans devoted for a particular purpose or against a particular asset, housing, can then be used for other purposes. There is fungibility of loans in this sense, and only a highly regimented economy with lots of controls that existed in the past, what will be very hard both to implement today and would cause great inefficiencies, could ever bring back. So I think that despite the superficial attractions of alternative instruments, it is still the responsibility of the MPC to set interest rates to maintain an overall balance. And I think the unease that you mentioned in the views of my former and my present colleague did not extend to giving up the inflation target. I think what it raised was the question, over what horizon should we bring inflation back to the target? That's always been part of the remit, and it was an issue which I raised in my lecture here 5 years ago when I spoke on the subject of the inflation target after 5 years. Now we've learnt even more after 10 years, but I don't think that anything we've learnt would want to make us think we should abandon the inflation target framework, rather than we need to think even more carefully about what is actually going on in the economy.
I don't want to labor this point, but you did mention earlier as well that you're talking about a possibility of tolerating higher deviation from your target now, so there may be a smaller deviation in the future. And the fact that you only have one policy instrument, which is interest rate, and we must not forget that even though it's difficult to postulate or speculate about asset prices and about house prices in particular, that has been mentioned many times before, but the possibility that we may get into a boom and a bust cycle for house prices, and given that you have only one policy instrument, and this tolerance about deviation between now and in the future, does it mean that you will consider having higher interest rates now so that you do not have to lower it further in the future?
Well, I'm not making any comment on the current policy stance. Each month the MPC meets and considers its policy position afresh. We always have an open mind at the beginning of each month. And last month we decided to leave interest rates unchanged. I do not know what we shall decide next month. The world would look different when we get to next month, and we'll make up our mind then. The point I wanted to draw attention to in the lecture was that on many occasions in the last few years, people have said, because of this asset price or that asset price, shouldn't you either raise or lower interest rates? But the question, which asset price? And what did that mean for interest rates? Some people said, exchange rate's very high, you should lower interest rates to try to bring the exchange rate down. Other people said, look, house prices are going up, you should raise interest rates. These arguments cannot stand by themselves. They have to be integrated into an overall analysis in the economy and what that means for the balance between demand and supply in the economy as a whole and the prospects for future inflation. And what I tried to show was that I think you can bring these things together in terms of a judgment about the likely path and the risks to that likely path of inflation over quite a long period in the future. And the particular difficulty which asset price changes raise is that the impact of their movements on inflation may be different in the short run than further ahead. And that's something that we simply can't avoid. We have to confront and make a judgment about. And our remit is to make sure that as we keep inflation as close to 2.5% as we can, as long as we can. And that we shall continue to do.
I think we have time for one more question, which I'll take that.
Thank you. How concerned are you with the public sector paid amounts?
Well, we are concerned only with pay pressures in general, insofar as they might put upward pressure on the inflation target. And we said in our inflation report last week that one of the upside risks to inflation looking further ahead would be the upcoming pay round over the next winter into the spring of next year, in part because of the expansion of the public sector, but mainly because of the impact that this might have on what is already a tight labour market. And we see perhaps some signs of easing in the labour market, which may diminish those risks. There is also, of course, the higher level of national insurance contributions which will come through that may put upward pressure on nominal pay settlements in both private and public sectors. So it isn't a question looking only at one particular sector, it's pay overall that will concern us. And so far, pay growth has been pretty benign. The rate of increase of average earnings has been completely consistent with the inflation target. So our concern would be what might happen at some point in the future if these risks were to materialise. But so far they haven't. But we shall be watching carefully during the upcoming pay round to see whether they do.
So it only remains for me to thank Mervyn for an entertaining and informative lecture. We look forward to inviting him again in 5 years' time for the inflation target of 15 years, by which time we'll probably only be whispering about inflation, I imagine. Although there is a paradox, I think, in what Mervyn was talking about, in that I'm sure after such an interesting lecture, we'll all be talking about inflation for the next few days. Thank you very much, Mervyn. I should just add one more thing. We have a reception in the senior dining room, which takes place immediately, and you're all welcome to join us for a glass of wine. Thank you.